Hi, this is Terry Moore, KI0RE in Colorado. This is the NLA Hams Net. We're starting late. I was out on the road the last 30 minutes, and I still am not home by a long shot. So poor planning on my part. Please forgive us. I'm not going to call roll today, but I would like to hear if anybody's made any progress or if they want to ask a question or make a comment. So I'm going to turn it open here for just a few minutes, and anybody can give me a call with your name and your state, or if you have it, a call sign, a name and a state. So I'll turn it open. Does anybody have any questions on ham radio? The noise was deafening.
I know. Everybody was talking at once. I couldn't understand them.
Okay. So has anybody made progress this week? Okay. Yeah. Anybody? Okay. So if you think of something you want to say, please give me your name or your call sign so that I know who to call on. Because that's how it's done in the radio. It's called simplex if there's only one person at a time talking. It's called duplex if you're doing it across a repeater because you're talking on one frequency, which has an offset, and the repeater is listening on that frequency and then putting it out on another. So everybody tunes to the output of the repeater. And like a VHF, on VHF, 144 to 148 megahertz, the offset is 600 hertz. So 600 hertz down or 600 hertz up from the output of the repeater is the frequency that the repeater will be listening on. So you kind of have to know that, or it's very difficult to talk to a repeater. Nice thing about a repeater is it's listening, and if you hit it with just a watt or two, because it's FM, lots of times you capture it, and your signal is amplified, and it's put out at 30, 40, 50 watts, and the repeater antenna is usually up high. And so that means it reaches further. So it reaches further, and you can take your little HT at 2 watts, hit a repeater that's up on a hill or a mountain, 10 miles away, and all of a sudden everybody can hear you for 50, 60 miles. That's the advantage of a repeater. So simplex. That's duplex because you're talking on one frequency and listening on the other. Simplex is where you're talking on the same frequency. I talk a little bit, and then I open up the frequency. I quit transmitting. I release the press the talk button, and then somebody else talks. Are there more? Yeah, there's different things. There's multiplex, and there's all kinds of things, and Jan probably knows more about it than I do. The thing about simplex is that you're going to be talking on the same frequency that you're listening on. So there is no offset. Both of them have their places. Usually near a large place, a population place, you'll hear people talking on a repeater. And that's because they're trying to use the repeater to get out to the whole populace all at once. If you want to talk between cars as you're going down the road, it's better to talk simplex so that you're not tying up a repeater. But if you've got a long train of cars, you got maybe 6 cars, then the repeater makes a lot of sense. For example, going into work or coming home from work, around major population centers, you can get on a repeater and you'll hear 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 guys that are spread across the area in their cars talking to each other about guns, ham radios, antennas, and whatever else comes to mind. It's good that if you're going to have your radio, that's a good way to listen during rush hour. Turn on your radio and tune it to a local repeater and just listen if there's anybody on it and if they're having a big conversation. I used to do it on the bus, and I'd always pick a seat on the bus that my antenna could face out the window to the mountains to the west. So no matter which way I was going, I would pick a west-facing window. And then I could listen to these guys all day long. And I would plug in a earphone, and I'd have my speaker mic, and I could jump in once in a while. But my signal wasn't as good as theirs because I only had an HT and a battery. Okay. Do we have any questions so far?
This is KZ3HBA, Pennsylvania, Jan. This is kind of halfway on topic, halfway off topic. We have a new supposed cell tower, or whatever, just 3-4 miles across the valley. And in their infinite wisdom, it's in the bottom of the valley, which makes you wonder what on earth it's for. Now, it's a tall tower. It's in hundreds of feet high. And it has, cylinders that may be 10 feet high in arrays, probably 10 or 12 around the band at one elevation on there, and I think they have more on the top. Do you have any idea what on earth these are for?
Yes. Assuming it's a cell tower, as you say, those are repeaters for cell phone coverage. And the length of the little round box or squarish round cylinders will kind of give you an indication of what band they're on. Now, I used to know the cell tower frequencies. They were between 800 and 900 megahertz, and then up at 1.3 or something. I can't remember what the other one was. And as the data usage has increased, they've kept going up in frequency. Now, cell towers use one frequency to talk to your radio, to your cell phone, which is what I'm on right now, and a different frequency to send the other side's information back at the same time. It's true duplex. So your cell phone is always listening on one frequency, and when you talk, you're sending out your information on a different frequency so that they're both live at all times on a cell phone. And the cell phone does a whole bunch of other mystical things that I can't get into right now, but it's different than duplex. And the height of those cylinders will tell you roughly the frequency. Does that make sense, Jim?
Yeah, except why would you put a cell tower in the bottom of the valley instead of on top of the mountain?
Okay. It's at the bottom because it probably can talk all the way up that valley. If it's a relatively straight valley for some distance, that's a good place because no matter where you put it, one valley will get if you put it up on the ridge, one valley will get good coverage and the other two will get spotty coverage because they may be shadowed by the curvature of the hill that it's on. So it's good to have up as high as you can get them. But sometimes the only way that you can really get good coverage is to put it down in the valley where it goes through. We have some repeaters here. The colocon.org, which is Colorado Connection. And we put a repeater that talks on a little bit different side tone, put it on away from the mountains, up on just a little hill here in Broomfield, halfway between Boulder and Denver. And it had better coverage because it was lower. It actually had better coverage because it could penetrate up the canyons a little better than having it on a mountaintop, the main repeater on the mountaintop, where it wouldn't talk very well once you got into certain canyons. So they usually work these things out, and they know what they want to do. And I'm going to say that if there's that many on there, they found a really good spot that they could talk and service a lot of people on cell phones, and that they've had reports of bad services, and so they expanded their capabilities there. And that's a good thing. Does that answer your question, Jan?
Yep. But they're missing a lot of coverage by putting it down that low.
Maybe. Maybe that's where they get the best coverage for the valley. The valleys. Maybe it's one valley, maybe it's two valleys, maybe it's four or five valleys. I don't know. But I know that your geography there in Pennsylvania, in parts of it, it may be the case where you're at, I don't know, is a lot of hills that are interspersed with these really tight, steep valleys that really can't go anywhere. They go, southwest to northeast along the Appalachian. They line up that way or something. But the mountains are not really above anything else, and the tops of the mountains don't really align with the valleys. So if you get up to a high spot and you look down and you can see this part of the valley but not the stuff before it and the stuff after it, that's not the greatest place. But if you're in a valley and you can go down and the signal will bounce off the sidewalls of the valley because it's all rock, that could be a very good place to have a cell phone tower that would talk all the way up and down that valley. And depending on how many people are there, that's maybe a very good place to locate it.
I'm reminded of the history books when I was a kid saying that the Appalachians are the old worn down mountains, you know. They aren't like the Rockies. We don't have much rocky side slopes like you do out in the Rockies or those areas. And our local amateur ham radio club has two repeaters, and they cover 60, 70 miles, and they're on top of the mountain, both of them.
Wow.
That's why it made me wonder why on earth they would put these down. I didn't even know they were there because they're in the ground practically, you know, until I happened to drive by them the other day, and you can't see them for more than maybe half a mile or a mile away because there's hills around them. Just a very curious thing. I just wanted something else with it.
Well, you also got to realize that the cell towers are made for a very local area.
Yeah.
Cell towers use a lot less power than a repeater does. And because of that, they need lots of them all over the place. And they place those towers so that they overlap with as many towers as possible. So if the signal isn't getting through over here, it automatically goes to the other one. And so it's kind of an engineering problem to find out where you can put the towers to get the best service in that area. So I would think that they're not very powerful. The repeater, on the other hand, is probably 100 or more times more powerful than what you hear on the cell phone tower.
Yeah. It's interesting. There is a cell tower about 4 or 5 miles away, just about in line with that tower. And I can see the beacon at night and it's blinking red, and this one is so low I can't even see it at night.
Interesting. Well, it'd be interesting to know exactly what it is. Usually you can go to the FCC and put in the coordinates and get what the license is for a particular one, but that doesn't always work. I had mixed results when I tried something like that.
Okay, we need to sleuth it a little.
Yeah, you need to sleuth it a little bit.
Okay, thanks.
Because I could
be
totally
wrong.
Hey, this
is Greg in Florida.
Yes, Greg.
I got a question relating to that. Why do they use such large diameter cables if you only need such a low amount of wattage?
Good question.
The wattage isn't necessarily doesn't drive how big the cable is or whatever size the cable is. It's what frequency you're going to put across that cable and how much reactance the radio needs and the antenna needs for the frequency you're using. So you can use, for instance, RG8 is 50 ohms, and it's about the size of your little finger, or my little finger, or Jan's little finger, I would say. I got fat hands, so it's about the size of my little finger. But if you're a woman, you probably have a thinner finger, unless you got fat hands also. So hang on, I got to shift. So what they do is they build RG8U for 50 ohms. So it's 50 ohms reactance, which is it's reactance is resistance for a frequency. So in the formula for reactance, it also includes the it includes the frequency, depending on whether it's capacitive reactance or inductive reactance. So I'll stop right there so we don't get anybody lost. Just realize that you need to match the reactance on a particular frequency of the antenna, the radio, and the transmission device, which is the cable, which could be any kind of coax. Now, inside of a car, you can also use RG58U, which is a very thin stuff. It's maybe a quarter inch in diameter. And that's better for a car. You still get 50 ohms, but it's not. It's a little more lossy. You lose some of the power depending upon how long it is. On the fat cables, you lose power on the length also. And so there's the trade-off. So you want to use the big fat cables because they're not as lossy as the tiny little cables. But it's got to match the reactance of the transmitter and the antenna. So they pick one for their frequency, and that's what they use. Does that make sense, Greg?
Yeah, they just look huge. I mean, like, you know, 3/4 of an inch in diameter or an inch.
Oh, yeah. There's, like, hardline. Some of the best stuff you can get is hardline, and it has a very low loss. But it doesn't bend as well, hence the word hardline. And it just depends on what situation they're using. And we could go on for a couple of hours about capacitor reactance, inductive reactance, the formulas, the frequencies, and what they fill the inside of the cable with. Usually it's a type of foam. And the foam keeps the center conductor, which mainly handles the power, a certain distance so that you have the right capacitance in there. And when you put that capacitance into the formula, you end up saying, okay, this is tuned for about 100, as just an example, 100 to 200 megahertz, which is in the neighborhood of what RG8U is, and RG58.
Okay. Thank you. That makes sense then.
Okay. Anybody else? Please speak up.
Are any of these frequencies high enough where they would use waveguides?
You can actually use waveguides for just about all of them. And
common.
There is a point where you have to start using waveguides because the foam core doesn't stand up real well and actually produces more reactants at higher frequencies. So the higher the frequency goes, the more chance there is that you do have to use a waveguide. And it just depends on what you're doing and when. Now, somebody's going to ask, what is a waveguide? And that's just imagine a small rectangle that's extruded to some length, and it's empty. And you actually have a waveguide at that point. What they found is as you get to be higher frequency, the actual current isn't moving through anything except the outside of the coax or whatever you've got, the waveguide. And so you have to build a waveguide to the specific dimensions. And there's formulas for figuring out the dimensions of your waveguide based upon your frequency. So the sides are supposed to be a certain percent of your frequency in millimeters, and the ends and the tops, there are two different ones. So across the long side of a rectangle, and you just extrude that rectangle, you have to build it to those proportions. And then you have and something that changes it from a waveguide to wherever you're going to go, you usually have just a single probe sticking up in the middle of the waveguide, and just the energy goes down the center of that waveguide, and the back current follows the sides of the waveguide. But it's the sides that really count to carry the energy. I know I didn't do so well on that one. I haven't done waveguides in a long time.
not too many hams have them.
I can say that on the old AM transmitters, before they could manufacture coax for some of the low bands, you know, if you think your AM frequencies are based on 1 kilohertz or 1,000 kilohertz, which is 1 megahertz, but they could build waveguides. Well, if you use the formula, you find out that the waveguide for a station near the center of a broadcast band is about 4 or 5 inches across and about 2 inches, 3 inches tall. It's just a huge monster. But they could carry lots and lots of power on that. So they would build a waveguide and set it up on insulating stakes all the way out to the antenna and all the way up to the antenna on top of a tower. And it had different sections, and you could stick them together with bolts and nuts, and you could take them apart. And so you build it the way you need it. And there was a lot of AM transmitters, maybe there still is, that had waveguides all the way from the Radio Shack holding the transmitter up across to the tower, and then up the tower, you know, 500, 1,000 feet, whatever it is, into the AM transmitting antenna. I hope that gives you a little bit different perspective.
They're kind of a mechanics or a plumber's delight, you know?
Yeah, only plumbers had no idea what you're talking about.
No, they don't.
But the radio engineers did. So when they say the engineer at the radio station, that's exactly who would put that together and make it work and continue to make it work. Okay. Anybody else?
Come on. Come on.
Did I lose everybody? Jen, are you there?
No. I'm still here, yes. It looks like everybody
else
is still here. Oh. Several are muted. Yep.
Well, you guys are welcome to talk if you like and answer. You know, I don't know how well I've answered all the questions. I hope that I made sense enough to where people could make sense out of what I was saying. Is there anything anybody wants to know about or wants to ask any more questions? We're getting towards the end of the time here, Jan.
Right. Well, this is the kind of cold weather time when you don't go outside so much and gives you some time to sit inside and go through your ham test on the computer.
Oh, very good idea.
Get your books out and start studying for your license. I would highly recommend it to everybody on call.
Yeah. Miss a TV or two or TV yep. show or two, and take the time to study a little bit. Everybody knows where they can find my number. I'm always available, or almost always. I'd be happy to answer anybody's question. Or you can come here on Wednesday nights at 6 p.m. At 6 p.m. Colorado time, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and participate in the HamNet. And I want to encourage everybody to study because it isn't that hard to get a license. It's only 35 questions. They're all multiple choice, and all the answers are in the back of the book. Not on the test, but in the back of the book that you study from. So I would encourage everybody to take the time and learn that. Get in touch with their ham radio club or a local ham, and start taking a look and seeing what they can find out. Okay, if there's no other questions, I guess we'll close the net. Okay. Anybody else? Call now. Okay. Well, Jan, thank you very much for having the patience that you do, sir. I'm sorry that I wasn't here on time. I got wrapped up in everything that was going on, and I hope to not do that next time. My schedule has changed so much in the last few days, or last few weeks. So this has been the NLA Hams Net, and I guess we'll see you next week. Thanks very much, everyone, for participating. We'll see you later.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming. Talk to you next week.